what price we're going to charge, and how many units we're going to produce, right, to maximize the profits or minimize our losses. What will our profits be at a point of profit maximization, or if it's a case of loss minimization, what will our losses be? And if we are making a loss, then we're going to answer the question, should we stay open or close down? Now, in all the other markets, there's four type markets, right? We start with perfect competition, and then we talk about the other extreme, which is monopoly, and then we talked about the type market that is closer to perfect competition that we call monopolistic competition. In each of those cases, if I ask a question, what price should we charge or how many units should we produce, what was the answer? MR equals MC is the answer. Now, we're in the last type market that we call oligopoly. In this type market, what you're going to learn is that the MR equals MC rule is not as applicable. We can't use it like we can in the other three type markets. And the reason is mutual interdependence. The reason that we cannot use the MR equals MC rule of profit maximization, at least not as well as in the other type markets, is because one of the characteristics of an oligopoly is mutual interdependence. Now, what does that mean, mutual interdependence? That means that whatever I do is going to affect you. I mean, if we're competing, if we're in the same industry, and how many companies do we have in this industry? Well, I'm not looking for an exact number, of course, but one of the characteristics of oligopoly is you have a relatively few firms in the industry. Now, you don't have one, because if you had one, this would be a monopoly. But we have a relatively few. Now, what is a relatively few? Well, one way of looking at it is there are few enough firms whereby it's possible that representatives of each firm could meet in a location and amongst themselves they could collude. Now, that's not to say they will meet or that they will collude, but it's possible. See, if you're talking about perfect competition, let's take an example. Let's talk about potato farmers. Well, is it possible for all potato farmers to meet in one place at one time and decide amongst them what price to charge? No, it's not possible. There are too many of them. Or in monopolistic competition, now monopolistic competition, you're talking mainly about retail stores, right? Now, how many retail stores sell shirts? Well, a whole lot of them. Well, is it possible for all store owners that have a retail business that sells shirts for them to come together in one place to decide amongst themselves and to agree upon what price to charge? Well, no, that's not possible. There are too many of them. Now, what about monopoly? Well, are you going to have collusion in monopoly? No. Why? Well, there's no one to collude with. They're the only ones. So an oligopoly, see, is different because it's the only type market where you have few enough participants in the industry that it's possible for them to come together to collude. And because it's possible, there are few enough of them, and collusion is possible, the dovetail to that is mutual interdependence. Because there are only a few firms in this industry, then whatever one firm does, if we're all competing, for example, in the same industry, if I were to change my price, then that would greatly affect your decision making. Or if you were to change your price, or if you were to do any number of things, it's going to greatly affect my business. Now, the reason why this mutual interdependence is so important is microeconomics is all about what? What is this whole semester all about? Decision making. Now, mutual interdependence greatly influences this decision making. If we're competing together in an industry, if I'm going to make a decision to do this or the decision to do that, I have to first think about you and contemplate, well, if I do this, what are you going to do as a result? And if you do this, I'm affected one way. If you do something else, I'm affected another way. But I cannot make a decision here unless I first consider your reaction to my decision. Now, that's what makes oligopoly so different. Now, why can't we follow as well this MR equals MC rule of profit maximization? The reason is, if I do something different, my revenues are going to be affected by what you do, and I cannot 100% be sure about what you're going to do. Now, I may even know the direction that you'll take in terms of your decision, but to what extent will you make that change? And I don't know that for sure. So in other words, if I'm going to follow the M equals MC rule of profit maximization, I have to know what my revenues are, right? I have to know what my margin revenue is, right? I mean, how can I follow the M equals MC rule if I don't know what my margin revenue is? Now, I don't know what my margin revenue is exactly because if I make a change, I don't know for sure what you're going to do about that change, and yet the decisions that you make, the changes that you make, greatly affects my revenue. Now, you see the problem there? So in oligopoly, we have to have other methods of determining price and output. And that's basically what our discussion is all about when we're looking at an oligopoly. Well, how does it differ than the other markets, and how do we make decisions of price and output? Well, I'm sure I got ahead of myself, but what I was trying to do there is give you a broad overview of what an oligopoly is. Here in slide 16, an oligopoly, it says, what is an oligopoly? And the answer is a market structure characterized by a small number of firms whose behavior is interdependent. See, that interdependence means, well, whatever I do, it affects you, and whatever you do affects me. And some examples: automobiles, steel, soup, cereals. Monopolistic competition was mainly made up of retail stores, right? But retail stores buy from producers. Where retail stores are primarily in a monopolistic competitive type market, producers are primarily in oligopolistic type markets. You know, take cereals, for example. The last one here, we got automobiles, steel, soup, cereals. When you go into the grocery store, we have lots of choices in what type of cereal you want to buy, right? But have you ever noticed that if you look at the companies that make these cereals, there's only, you know, maybe two or at the most three companies that make these cereals? I mean, one company can make 25, 30 different kinds of cereal, right? So we're not looking at the types of cereal. What we're looking at is the company that makes that cereal. And same with the other markets. What is a possible explanation for the formation of oligopolies? Barriers to entry, such as economies of scale or high cost of entry. And I talked about this last time. This is still a review of the last lecture. But we do have very high barriers to entry in oligopoly for different reasons. Many of them have grown as large as they are because of positive economies of scale, high economies of scale, and as a result, their costs are lower, and it's very difficult to enter into these type markets to compete. Okay, and so here's just a picture of an economies of scale, meaning that as the company grows, for many reasons, the average cost of manufacturing or producing becomes less and less. So the more that's true, then the more difficult it would be for a newcomer to enter into the industry to compete. Now, what is collusion? An agreement among firms to divide the market or to fix the market price to maximize economic profit. Now, the point behind collusion is for the companies to behave collectively as if they were a monopoly. Now, if that's possible, I mean, that's the point of one point of collusion. If we can collude, it's like OPEC, is a cartel. It's an international organization made up of 13 or 14 of the world's countries that export oil, and OPEC colludes. Members come together and they decide amongst themselves what quantity to produce and therefore what price to charge, and they attempt to collectively act as if they were a monopoly. Now, that's not legal in the United States, because this type of collusion where companies actually can come together and behave as if they were a monopoly is against our antitrust laws. See, that's what trusts were. Around the turn of the in 1900, around the turn of the century there, in early 1900s, we had companies, all kinds of industries that became oligopolistic. You had relatively few firms, and they would collude. And we called these organizations trusts. So there was the Baker's Trust, and there was the Steel Trust, and there was the Copper Trust, and there was this trust, and there was that trust. And so in the 1930s, we came out with what are called antitrust laws. And our antitrust laws are against this type of collusion. Although you're going to find out later that not all types of collusion are illegal. But the type of collusion where companies actually come together and communicate for the purpose of acting as if they were a monopoly is the type of collusion that is illegal in the United States. But does that make the collusion amongst countries of OPEC illegal? Well, no. See, we can pass laws that affect the United States, but those laws don't affect the rest of the world. Now, this brings us to types of collusion: explicit collusion, cooperation involving direct communication between competing firms about setting prices. This is slide 21. So the type of collusion I've been talking about so far we would call explicit collusion. But there's another type of collusion that we call implicit collusion. Implicit collusion is cooperation involving indirect communication between competing firms about setting prices. And it's this implicit collusion that's not necessarily against the law. See, if all of us were competing against one another in an oligopolistic industry, there are many ways that we could collude and never communicate. Now, I believe I should have some examples of this. What is a cartel? A group of firms that agree to coordinate the production and pricing decisions, thereby behaving as a monopolist. A cartel is an international organization. And what are two examples of cartels? OPEC, Organization Petroleum Exporting Countries, which I already talked about, and the International Electrical Association. Let me talk about the International Electrical Association. That's an interesting type of cartel. This group, they build big electrical systems. Like if a town has grown into a city and that city wants to put in place a whole electrical system for the city, then there are companies that do that kind of large work. And internationally, these companies belong to the International Electrical Association. And so here's how it works. Let's say a city in Peru wants to build a electrical system, so it advertises this and it asks for bids. Now let's say that all of us are in this organization. We're different companies, but we're behaving. We see like this is an oligopolistic type organization. All right, this city in Peru asks for bids. Well, amongst us, if we're all together here, amongst us, we're going to decide before the fact who is going to win the bid. And, of course, we're going to take turns. Now, let's say that it's your turn to win the bid. So we say, okay, you bid this amount, and the rest of us will bid over that amount. And, of course, you win the bid. Now, of course, you're the lowest bidder, but is that bid as low as it would be if we weren't cooperating? Of course not. See, your bid is still very high, but it's lower than the rest of us, so you get the bid. And you make a lot of money because, hey, that bid you offered allowed you to make a very good profit. And then the next job that comes along, well, now it's someone else's turn. Now, what happens if a company, maybe from the United States, tries to enter into this situation? But, of course, the United States, this type of dealing is illegal. But they're not a part of the organization. And so they answer the advertisement and they submit a bid. And they could bid lower than the rest of us. Now, what are we going to do about that? Well, what we're going to do about that is now we're going to decide who is going to win this bid. But how we're going to make sure that we underbid the American company. They're going to bid such a low price that there is no way that they could even come close to covering their costs. And there's no way that the American company could bid below that because the bid that we're offering, the price that we're offering to do the business is so low. Of course, because we're part of an organization, what's the deal? How come you would agree to put a bid in knowing that you would lose a ton of money by winning the bid? Yeah, reimbursement, exactly. See, the answer is that because we've all decided this before the fact, then whoever is turned is to win the bid, the rest of us will say, well, because you've got a bid so low, we're all going to put money in the pot and we're going to give that money to you, and so that despite your low bid, you're still going to make a good profit. Well, if we do this every time that there's a job becoming available anywhere in the world, because this is a world organization, how many bids is this outsider going to win? None of them. And how long can that company exist and continue to make bids if they never win a bid? You see what I mean? Well, eventually, of course, they drop out and they're no longer around. And as soon as they're no longer around, then what can the rest of us do? Well, now with no outsiders making bids, we can go back to deciding, okay, who's going to win this bid? But instead of that bid being very low, that bid is going to be very high. Y'all see how this works? Now, is there any international organization, any authority that can legally come in and say, hey, this isn't fair, and you can't do this? No, we don't have any world organization that can do that. See, this is not illegal, because it's done on an international scope. Here we have a cartel model where firms act as a monopolist. Let's say that this were a monopoly. Here's a downward sloping demand curve, marginal revenue curve underneath the demand curve. We've got a marginal cost curve. Say, now, how many units are we going to produce to maximize the profit or minimize our losses? M equals MC, right? We go all the way up, all the way down. where that dotted line hits a demand curve, we come across, that's what price we're going to charge, and we come down the horizontal axis, and where we come out, that's the quantity we're going to produce. Now, here is the point, because we're not talking about monopolists, we're talking about an oligopoly, right? If we here are an oligopoly, a collusive oligopoly. Now, see, there are oligopolies and there are collusive oligopolies. The difference is that in an oligopoly, you don't have this formal type or explicit collusion. I said formal because sometime in economics we use different terms. Formal collusion is the same thing as explicit collusion. And informal collusion is the same as implicit collusion. So sometime one term is used, sometime the other. But the point here is that we are a collusive oligopoly. Therefore, we want to behave as a monopoly. If we're going to behave as a monopoly, what price are we going to charge? Price P, correct? Because that's where M R equals MC, and that's what a monopoly would charge, right? But if we're going to make it, see, now, what determines price? The market. See, now, I mean, we don't determine price. The market determines price. And a big part of the, you know, half of the market is demand, right? So demand determines price. Now, we can't control demand. We can't control demand. So given this demand curve, then we want to charge price P. But in order to charge price P, we have to do what? We have to produce quantity Q. Now, why is that a problem? I mean, for monopoly, it's not a problem. But we're not a monopoly. We're a collusive oligopoly. Now, why is that a problem? Are we all the same size? Are we identical? See, if we were all identical, let's say there's 10 of us, and if we were all identical, then we'd say, all right, in order to collectively produce quantity Q, we'll just divide it up into 10 equal parts, and each of us will produce a tenth of it. But is that realistic? No, in any oligopoly, you've got different sizes, different situations. Let's take OPEC, for example. You've got great big Saudi Arabia, and you've got little itty-bitty Kuwait. So the problem is, in order for us to collectively produce quantity Q, then how much is each one of us going to produce? How many barrels of oil is Saudi Arabia going to produce? How many barrels of oil is Kuwait going to produce? How many barrels of oil is Iran going to produce? Etc. Because collectively, our intention is to produce quantity Q. Otherwise, we're never going to get price P. And that becomes a monumental problem, especially in cases like OPEC. I mean, these countries that are members of OPEC historically have not been the best of friends. They've been enemies in the past. There's a lot of mistrust. There's all kinds of emotions, and it's not an easy thing for us to all cooperate. Now, y'all ever hear the saying that any chain is as strong as its weakest link? Well, how strong is a collusive oligopoly? See, what's one thing that can undermine this whole process?
One person decides not to.
Yeah, cheating, right? See, one participant might say, well, okay, I, like take Kuwait for example. Kuwait might say, okay, I agree to produce only this much oil, but under the table, I'm going to make private deals and produce more than that. Now, in the short run, that would really bring about big gains because you're going to that participant is that country is going to produce more oil and yet get the higher price. But of course, there are the time lags, right? And this type of information ultimately comes to the surface, and so what happens? Well, Q increases, there's cheating going on, Q increases, and therefore, what has got to happen to price? Price has to decrease. And if price decreases, then are we acting as, are we gaining that price as if we were a monopoly? See, the whole thing falls apart, and especially if one nation is caught cheating, then maybe another nation will cheat, and pretty soon we don't have any cooperation at all. Okay? Well, I meant to turn this thing off. We can't have an oligopoly unless we collude. Okay, what are problems with stability? Differences in cost. In other words, how can if we're an oligopoly, how can we be different from one another? Well, our cost could be much different. The number of firms in the market. I mean, one oligopoly might have two. In fact, we'd actually call it a duopoly. But you might have two firms, might have three firms, you might have 10 firms. Now, practically speaking, how many firms are we talking about here? See, what really makes this an oligopoly? What really makes this an oligopoly is that there are few enough of us where it's possible that we could all get together in one place at one time, talk to one another, and collude. Now, is that 10? Is that 12? Is that 15? I mean, however number it is, that's what makes an oligopoly an oligopoly. All right? See, there's no specific number. We can't say, well, an oligopoly is 14 firms, and over that it's not an oligopoly. Well, see, we have no exact number here. It's just a number that, hey, this explicit or formal collusion is at least possible. Okay, so we got number of firms is new entries. See, that's a problem with stability, because as we get new firms entering in here, then our ability to collude becomes less and less and less. Of course, another factor of oligopoly is that we do have these high barriers to entry. So it is difficult to enter in, but not impossible. And the barriers to entry into an oligopolistic industry are not as high as into a monopoly-type market. And, of course, cheating is a problem when you're talking about stability. What distinguishes oligopoly? Interdependent. No firm will take an action unless it considers the reaction from the other firms. And imagine three identical firms in an industry, A, B, and C. What happens if A raises price? B and C will not raise their price. Three firms in an industry. A raises price. Everything else being equal now, assuming nothing else changes, A raises price. Why will B and C benefit by not raising their price?
Sell more.
Yeah, I could sell more. If there's only three firms in this industry and one raises price and the other two don't, then the two that don't are going to gain a lot of business. Therefore, if everything else being equal now, we're assuming nothing else is changing, if A raises price, B and C will stay pat. They will not raise theirs, correct? In other words, a price increase will be ignored by the competitors. But now what happens if A lowers price? Again, everything else being equal. What's B and C going to do? They're going to lower their price because if A lowers price and B and C don't, then A is going to gain a lot of the business. So B and C will say, well, in order for us to maintain market share, we're going to have to lower our price too. So in other words, a price hike will be ignored. A price cut will be followed. Again, assuming everything else the same. Nothing else is changing except for the price change. What is a price leader? A firm whose price is adopted by the rest of the industry. Now we're talking about implicit or informal collusion. How can we all agree on what price to charge, what quantity to produce, without communicating? Well, one way is for us to, at some point along the way, designate who the price leader is going to be. Now, how do we do that? Well, it may be the first firm that's in industry. It may be the largest one. It may be the one that just, because of past history, a leadership role. So what I'm talking about here is a price leader. We appoint a price leader, and then we simply follow the leader. In other words, the leader determines what price to charge, and then the rest of us look at that price and follow suit. Now, how does a price leader determine what price to charge? Well, there are many methods that can be used. One might be cost plus pricing. The leader might say, well, these are our costs, and we think that we ought to want to make a 25% profit, so we're going to simply take our costs, add 25%, and that's the price we're going to charge. Now, once they determine that price, then the rest of us will say, well, they're charging this price for comparable products, so we're going to charge the same as that they're charging. See, we're colluding, but we're never communicating. Now, if we never communicate, can this be against the law? In other words, what proof is it that we're colluding? And there is, see, it'd be very difficult to prosecute informal collusion, or what is called implicit collusion. Now, but the reality is that we wouldn't want to prosecute this form of collusion anyway. How come that is? Well, the reason that is because we recognize that this type of market cannot follow the M equals MC rule of profit maximization, and therefore they have to have some method of determining price. And that method ultimately is going to entail some kind of informal collusion. So legally we say, well, that's okay as long as they don't take unfair advantage of their situation. Now, if even this informal type of collusion really got out of hand, then maybe the legal authorities would intervene. But mainly speaking, they do not prosecute this type of informal collusion. So who is the price leader? Well, it might be the barometric firm, which means a firm that has proven in the past that they're more sensitive to market changes. The dominant firm might be the largest firm, or it might be the firm that's just, for some reason, has taken a leadership role in the past. Or maybe the most innovative firm. Okay, what is cost plus pricing? A method of determining the price of a good by adding a percentage markup to average variable cost. In other words, we look at our cost and then add a certain amount. That's our price. This is what the leader does, and then others follow suit. Now, this works because in this type of oligopolistic industry, if the leader says, okay, this is what my costs are, and then I'm going to add this percent, does that apply to the rest of us? Well, basically speaking, it does. Why? Because we're all buying our resources from the same market. Like, let's take the automobile industry. Well, Ford Motor buys steel from the same market that General Motors does, that Toyota does, at least in the United States. See what I mean? I mean, take the automobile industry. There, at least the three American companies are controlled by the UAW. Now, of course, the others aren't. And that's a problem in the automobile market, and one reason why the American companies are going bankrupt. But the point here is that if the leader follows his cost plus pricing and determines a price, that price will probably be a good price for the rest of us, because the rest of the cost for everyone is going to be near the same. Not exactly the same, of course, because we're different companies. But but the costs aren't going to be greatly different in an oligopoly from one firm to another, because they're buying their resources from the same markets. Okay, so what is game theory? A model that analyzes oligopolistic behavior as a series of strategic moves and counter moves by rival firms. Now, see, this mutual interdependence thing, whatever you do affects me and whatever I do affects you. Now, how many possibilities are there? Well, there are many, many different possibilities. There are many, many different things I can change, and with everything I change, there are many different actions you can take. So what game theory is all about is these different scenarios. What game theory is all about is the hypothesizing, okay, if we do this, then everyone else is going to do something. If we do something different, then these are the different possibilities. You know, it's possibility A, possibility B, possibility C. So we get like this big matrix. This big matrix is all the possible decisions we can make, and then all the possible repercussions of those changes in terms of your decision to do, you know, as your reaction to whatever change I make. So there's a whole field of economics and microeconomics called game theory. I mean, it's a whole, like, I mean, I'm not sure, but you probably get a PhD in game theory. Okay. And a duopoly, I mentioned before, is only when you have two firms in the industry. And what is strategy? In a game theory, the operational plan pursued by the player is called strategy. Every firm has its own strategy in terms of how it plays the game. And a payoff matrix. In game theory, a table listing the payoffs that each player can expect based on the strategy that each player pursues. So that's what I alluded to before, this game theory, this matrix, all the possible combinations of possibilities. Now, here's where I come to answer your question. What is a kink demand curve? A demand curve that illustrates price stickiness. If one firm cuts price, others will cut theirs, but if the firm raises price, others will not change theirs. And here is a picture of a kink demand curve, and this is what is so unique to an oligopoly. How do we derive price P? I'm looking at slide 38, and we've got vertical axis, horizontal, price, quantity, a kink demand curve, and where that kink is, if we go across the price axis, we come out of price P. How is price P determined? Well, what have we been talking about? There are many different methods. One method is follow the leader, right? See, in other words, price P has not been determined by the market like the other markets. There are type industries, you know, perfect competition, monopolist competition. Price P is the price that members of the oligopoly have agreed to. Now, how they agreed to it, we don't know. But we're just saying this is the price. This is the price that we've all agreed to. So that's where we start. Now, what we're saying here, say, if three firms, firm A raises price, what's B and C going to do? Not raise their price, right? Therefore, let's say that you're firm A and you raise price. Your demand curve, more elastic or inelastic? More elastic. Why more elastic? Three firms. We start at price P. Firm A raises price. The demand curve that firm A faces is very elastic. meaning that it's more horizontal than vertical. At least that's one way of looking at it. Now, how come? Because if A raises price and B and C do not raise their price, what happens to the quantity demanded for A's product? It changes a lot, right? Now, if you change price and the quantity demanded for your product changes a lot, elastic or inelastic? Elastic. And what does the elastic demand curve look like? It's more horizontal. But now below price P, now let's say three firms, A, B, and C, A lowers price. What's B and C going to do? Follow the price cut. And if A lowers price and B and C lowers their price, comparing demand curves, more elastic or inelastic? More inelastic. Why? Because now a price change is not going to have that much impact on the quantity demanded. How come? Well, because everyone's a price cut will be followed. See, in the other, when company A raised price, well, there's a big change because a lot of consumers bought from B and C. But if A lowers price and then B and C right away lower their price, well, there's not going to be that much, you know, market share isn't going to change that much. And therefore, the demand curve is more inelastic below price P, and that's how we get this, what is called kink demand curve. Now, the demand curve we're looking at here is the solid line. This is a solid blue above P and then solid green below P. And because we have a kink demand curve, we also have a broken marginal revenue curve. We have one marginal revenue curve that follows the demand curve above P and one marginal revenue curve that follows the demand curve below P. And this is a picture of the broken marginal revenue curve. Okay, how does price under oligopoly compare to price under perfect competition? Price is usually higher under oligopoly because of the greater market power and because, again, of the different slopes of the curves. Now, can firms that's part of an oligopolistic market make a economic profit over the long run? Well, it's possible. How come? Because the barriers to entry are so high. Not as high as monopoly, but they're still very high. So economic profits can be made, but is that going to encourage others to enter into the industry to partake in the profits and thereby shifting the supply curve to the right? Well, not very likely. See, how do profits under oligopoly compare to profits under perfect competition? Profits are higher under oligopoly because they collectively they can behave as if they were a monopoly. Now, different types of business oligopolistic type of organizations. A horizontal a merger in which one firm combines with another firm that produces the same product. See, this is what we've had in the banking industry, particularly over the past 6 months to a year. The past 6 months, we've had a tremendous increase in big banks buying up little banks, and so that the vast majority of all banking now in America is controlled by five banks. So what is our banking industry? Is an example of an oligopoly. See, well, a lot of things that we've been talking about here apply to our banking industry. You see, why is it that banks have been given so much money by the government with the under the TARP bailout plan? One problem is leverage, right? I mean, that's really the source of a lot of our problems today. You're playing with $1, but you borrow $99. So you're playing with like you had $100, so that any gain you make is greatly multiplied, even though that $99 is borrowed. If you gain enough, you can pay back that $99 and still make a tremendous profit because you were playing like you had $100 instead of just $1. That's leverage. So the key to really making vast sums of profit of money is leverage. The more you leverage, the more money you can make. But What's the downside of leverage? Very risky. And just as the going up is multiplied, the coming down is multiplied. And that's why so many banks are in financial trouble. Because they made a ton of money because they were so leveraged. But when things started to head south, everything fell apart. But what was their solution? Well, they went to Congress and they pointed a gun to their heads and they said, you bail us out. You give us these billions of dollars, or we're going to go under, and we're too big to fail. See, we're an oligopoly. We're too big to fail. If we fail, and since banking is so central to everything that this country stands for economically, then everything will collapse. And so what does the government do? Oh, well, you're too big to fail, so we'll support you and give you all this money. See, but the point I'm making, see, we're talking about an oligopoly here, right? I mean, how is it that banks should go to Congress and point a gun to their heads and say, give us, it's just like a bank robbery. I mean, banks went to the Congress and it's just like they're robbing a bank. And they said, give us this money or else. Now, how could they do that? Because they are an oligopoly. So anyway, that's what's called a horizontal merger. When you've got one bank buying another bank, then you've got that's what's called this horizontal merger. And by the way, what banks made the most of these very risky type of investments that were so highly leveraged? Your bigger banks or your smaller community banks? Bigger banks. So when things started to head south, what did the financial statements look like for a smaller bank compared to a bigger bank? Well, the books for a big bank looked terrible, but the financial assets, the books for the little bank still looked pretty good. So what did the bank do to make their books look better? Bought out the little bank. See? And that's one of the reasons why they bought out these little banks. Okay, so what is a vertical merger? Well, another type of merger is a merger in which one firm combines with another from which it purchases inputs or to which it sells. Like a vertical merger, if you can imagine, one country may buy resources from other companies. Well, instead of buying your resource from another company, you simply buy out those other companies, and therefore you're essentially buying from yourself. So that's what's called a vertical merger. Now, a conglomerate merger would be the combination of companies that are completely unrelated. One reason why companies may want to do this is because of simply size. With an increase in size, it experiences economies of scale. And another reason would be diversification, maybe. By being a conglomerate, maybe if you're made up of a lot of different type of companies from different industries, well, as we have a business cycle and things get better and things get worse, different industries are affected differently in the upturns or downturns. So with a conglomerate, if you own all kinds of different types of companies, then it could give you more stability as the business cycle went up and down. You see what I mean? And another reason why conglomerates became popular at one point is because this was one way around our antitrust laws. See, an antitrust law says that if companies combine and the government says that there's too much market concentration here, that's detrimental to the consumer, then this type of combination is illegal according to antitrust laws. But a company can grow to be very large as a conglomerate and not run afoul of our antitrust laws, because antitrust laws only apply to specific industries. See how that works? Now, how successful have these conglomerates been? Well, there's less of this going on today, and a lot of conglomerates have sold off many of their units because many companies found that by growing large as a conglomerate just had too many problems associated with it. You're combining different, you're bringing in so many elements that are so different that to behave as one unified company was very, very difficult and actually caused more problems than it solved. And so many of these in the recent past, many organizations that used to be very large conglomerates have sold off many of their units and gone back to their roots. That's not true in every case, but that's generally true. And this is the end. Well, so this finishes chapter 10. So what are they all going to do for next time? Read the next chapter, right? So I shall see you all next time.